just dedicate this evening's Divrei Torah to the Elohim HaNeshama of Yosef ben Aaron Shmuel, Hashem Yikom Domo. That is Mr. Joseph K. Miller. His yard site is this Shabbos, Parshas Vayechi, Yud Dalet Teves. And the shir is in loving memory of him, as well as a schus l'refuah shlema for a number of those who were injured in this terrible accident. Miriam Bas Ina Pesio Cheved, Chana Eliana Bas Naomi, and Rachel Esther Bas Tamar. We hope that they will all have a refuah shlema v'karov, a refuah ha-nefesh, a refuah ha-guf. I'm sure they need both. And we hope that our Divrei Torah will be a schus both for an Ilui HaNeshama for Mr. Miller, as well as a refuah shlema for them. So we started to talk last week about certain situations where Amira La'akum would be permissible. So what are those situations where Amira La'akum would be allowed? Number one, we said if you have a chole. So when we talk about a chole, obviously if we have a chole sheyesh bo sakana, if we have a chole whose life is in danger, we're allowed to do anything. You don't have to turn to a non-Jew. Do it yourself. A Jew is actually encouraged. The Rambam says that it should be done al yidei ha-gedolim. It's a discussion in the Acharonim what exactly the Rambam means. Does he mean it should be a gadol as opposed to a katan? Or does he mean a gadol, meaning the leader? Should it be the leaders of the community going out and showing by example, this is what we do when somebody's life is in danger, that we try our best to be helpful, that we do whatever is possible to assist that patient and to give them the opportunity to rehabilitate themselves. So that is obviously category number one, which is not what we're discussing. If there's a real danger, every Jew should do whatever needs to be done immediately, and there should be no hesitation. However, we have a second category, which is referred to as a chole she'ein bo sakana, which means you have somebody who's not well. So, for example, he's muta l'mishkav. You have somebody who has a terrible migraine. They're not able to function normally. And as a result of that, it's ruining their entire Shabbos. So somebody like that, the Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Shin Chav Ches, which is the Simen in Shulchan Aruch, all about Hilchos Refuah b'Shabbos. So there the Shulchan Aruch says you would be allowed to ask a non-Jew even to violate a malacha mida araisa, which is a tremendous chiddush, but that is what the Shulchan Aruch says. Now the Shulchan Aruch says that there are two categories of people that without knowing anything else just automatically would have the status of being a chole she'ein bo sakana. Who are those two categories of people? Number one, it's somebody who is a katan, somebody who's a young child, and if they don't get what they want, you can't reason with them. They're not really going to fully understand or appreciate your logic and your reasoning. And as a result of that, it's going to make them not be able to function in the normal way in which they otherwise would. That person is considered to be a chole b'Shabbos. And the Mishnah Berurah says, based on the Shulchan Aruch, that if a child needs something, let's say they need a bottle, and I don't have any milk in the house, and I need to have milk brought from somewhere else, but that would require some sort of malacha being done as a result, we would allow that to have a non-Jew do that because a chole is not only defined as somebody who has muta l'mishkav, who's actually in bed, but somebody who is not functioning normally, and a young child is certainly considered to be that. We did discuss at what age does a child lose that status of being a chole. Do we say under bar mitzvah? So it seems not. My father is of the opinion, like the Chazon Ish, that it's basically like a 2 or 3 year old that doesn't have the das, that doesn't have the capability to understand when I logic and reason with them. At least my 2 year olds aren't able to. Maybe everybody else's are different. But in a situation like that, the Shulchan Aruch would say that that is considered to be a chole she'ein bo sakana. The second category of people who's automatically a chole she'ein bo sakana is hakol cholim etzel tzina. When it was freezing cold in Europe, and there was an assumption that people were able to get sick as a result of being so cold, that would be automatically somebody is considered to be a chole she'ein bo sakana when it is freezing cold and you need something implemented to heat them up. So you would be allowed in a situation like that to ask a nachri to heat up, let's say, logs of wood, even to do a malacha d'araisa to help out the chole she'ein bo sakana. Based on that, there's a tremendous chiddush of today, which is that today, the same way hakol cholim etzel tzina, the same way the Shulchan Aruch says that everybody was accustomed to having a heating system back in the days of the Gemara, so too we are all accustomed to having an air conditioner. And if it's boiling hot outside in a burning hot summer day, and the air conditioner blows, you would be allowed to ask a nachri to turn it on, because even though that may include a malacha d'araisa, which is not clear, but it might include a malacha d'araisa, we would allow that because hakol cholim etzel tzina, v'hakol cholim etzel achol. You have people who are not muta l'mishka, people who aren't feeling well. Let's say you have a running nose, you're congested, So you need some kind of something, but you're not really, really sick. You're functioning. You would go to work that day. You could just use a little bit of assistance. In a case like that, the Shulchan Aruch says, since your chola, since your illness is bumped down a notch, so what we are going to allow is also down a notch, which we allow a shvus to shvus b'makam chola. So we would allow a double derabbanan. So derabbanan number one is you can ask a non-Jew to do a malacha derabbanan. So for example, somebody who's congested and needs some kind of fruit because it's going to help them feel a little bit better, they need some kind of drink, they need a tea from across the street and there's no Erev and it's only a karmelis midirabanan, it's only Rishus HaYachim midirabanan, in a situation like that, we would allow somebody to have a nachri do what we refer to as a shvus to shvus b'makam chola, a double derabbanan. So again, derabbanan number one is asking the non-Jew. Derabbanan number two is that the non-Jew himself is only doing something which is only aser midirabbanan. The third category of chola is somebody who has a mechush ba'am. That's nothing at all. Somebody just has a slight little bit, and that we would not allow one to violate amira la'akum. We then talked about when there is a second allowance to violate amira la'akum, and that is b'makam mitzvah. So the Gemara Gittin says that buying a piece of property in Eretz Yisrael is considered to be a very important mitzvah. What the Gemara is describing there, by the way, is buying a piece of property from a non-Jew who lives in Eretz Yisrael. If I'm just buying a property from another Jew, we're just flipping real estate, that's not what the Gemara is describing. We're talking there where you are now saving a piece of land from being in non-Jewish owned hands. Doesn't mean a terrorist, but it means the Jews are supposed to be living in Israel. And instead of a non-Jew living on this property, I now go ahead and purchase that property for myself. In a situation like that, the Shulchan Aruch says, I'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to sign the contract for me, even on a Shabbos. Kosvan alavono afilu b'Shabbos. What you see from there is, it would seem that I'm allowed to violate Amir la'akum on a malacha de'araisa, ksiva, right? That's an issa de'araisa. Sounds like I'm allowed to ask a non-Jew to do a malacha de'araisa for me on Shabbos. Why? Because it's a mitzvah. To buy property in Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah. And therefore, we'd be allowed. The problem with that is, we have a Gemara Maseches Erevin, where the Gemara tells us that they used to have the medical belief that a young child, upon having a bris milah, needed to have hot water poured on them. They needed to have a bath before and a bath after. So the Gemara there tells a story about Hahu Yenuka de Ishtapech Chamime. There was a child who was having a bris milah, and the water spilled. And the Gemara gets into a whole discussion. What were they going to do? They should have a non-Jew go and get the water from somewhere else. So the question is, if you have a non-Jew available, why don't you just tell him to turn on the bath, turn on the hot water here, and heat it up? Why do you have to ask him to go somewhere else? So it seems from the Gemara, what the Rishonim learn, is we would only allow it if the non-Jew was being asked to do a malacha derabbanan. How could it be? We just said the Gemara says you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to sign the contract on Shabbos, which is an issa d'araisa of ksiva. So which one is it? So there's two approaches in the Rishonim. Some Rishonim say the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is so much greater than any other mitzvah that we would allow something that we would never allow for any other mitzvah. Which is interesting. So much greater than bris milah. Bris milah is pretty important as well. And yet the Gemara seems to say that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is very, very critical. And we would make a special allowance for that, even though we wouldn't allow that for a bris milah. Fascinating. The other approach of the Rishonim is, no, that we do not allow an issa d'araisa to be violated for a makom mitzvah. I'm sorry, no, the other approach of the Rishonim is that Gemara is correct, that we allow even an issa d'araisa to be violated for any mitzvah that one is performing, whether it's Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or Bris Milah or anything, and it's a machlokas between the sugyas, and we apply that sugya Maseches Gittin, that's the one that we accept lahalacha. That is the big machlokas in Shulchan Aruch. So the Shulchan Aruch says that generally the accepted opinion is that we do not allow an issa d'araisa to be violated for the sake of a mitzvah. We only allow an issa d'rabbanan. We would only allow an issa d'rabbanan, except the Bala Iter has the famous position that he adopts that position of the Gemara that even for malacha d'araisa you'd be allowed to. And the Ramah says when you have a major tzarech gadol, you'd be allowed to rely on the opinion of the Bala Iter. That's what the Ramah writes. So that leaves us with a very complicated answer. We would really say that Amir al-Nachri b'makom mitzvah is only allowed when you're asking the Nachri to do a malacha d'rabbanan, not a nisa d'araisa. But says the Ramah, you can follow the Bala Iter if it's a tzarech gadol. What's a tzarech gadol? So the Mishnah Berurah qualifies it by saying a tzarech gadol would certainly be if I have an Erev in town and the Erev rips on a Shabbos. So some, you know, there's a storm and the Erev rips on a Friday night and I know that everyone's going to have to carry on Shabbos. I can't get the word out to everybody to let them know that the Erev is down. So what do I do? It happens to be that the Shulchan Aruch says, even if I have a community where I have an Erev up on a regular, every week, there's never a storm, no problem. It says that one Shabbos year, you're supposed to take the Erev down so that everybody remembers that there's a Malach of Hotzah. I don't think we do that here, right? Do we ever do that? There's supposed to be a Shabbos Hotzah. It's supposed to be a Shabbos where we remind everybody, by the way, there is a Malach of Hotzah of the Shabbos. It happens to be that in this community that we live, there is an Erev, and most of the weeks we're able to carry, but we should remember that there is such a thing. Why should we remember? Because you're once going to find yourself in Kansas, where there may not be an Erev, or in Kentucky somewhere, there is no Erev there, so you have to remember that when you go there for Shabbos, you have a Malach of Hotzah. And if our children are all going to be raised with this understanding that carrying on Shabbos is no issue at all, we never think twice about it, then that may be a mikshal, that may be a problem when they're visiting a foreign location without thinking. And this comes up all the time. I gave an example about Kansas. I wasn't trying to call out Kansas because I don't like them or because I don't think there's an error. I'm sure there is. But the reason when it's relevant is many, many times people go away on a program for Shabbos or Yom Tov. They go to a hotel and the operators of the program do not build an error around the whole campus. They don't always do that. Just be aware. So everybody assumes, you know, we're so used to carrying on Shabbos, we don't even think twice. So people don't ask. They want to take a walk with the stroller, with the wheelchair. They want to carry water outside when they're taking a walk, wherever they are in the mountains or wherever they are in Connecticut, by the hotel or in Hawaii, wherever they go for Shabbos. Actually, Hawaii is not a good idea for Shabbos. But wherever you're going to be for a Shabbos, people want to take a walk, and they don't remember that we have to inquire whether or not there's actually an Erev. Most programs do not build an Erev all around the perimeter of the grounds. That would be a tremendous cost. If we're only taking it over for one Shabbos, who's going to do that? So even if you go away to a bar mitzvah, and it's in Connecticut, not so far away, you have to really find out whether this is true. And the problem is that we're not trained to think about this because we are used to having an Erev every week, so we never even ask, we never even think. And when there's a problem with the Erev in our community, we send out an email. But here, the Mishnah Berurah says, if the Erev goes down in a community where there's an Erev every Shabbos and it's expected that the Erev is going to be up, that would certainly be a Tzarech Rabim, and we would be allowed to ask a Nachri to go ahead and do whatever needs to be done, even if it requires an Isser De'oraisa, even if it requires the Nachri to do a real Malacha De'oraisa, we would allow that. So, Ramosha writes in a Tshuva, what happens if the lights go out in the shul and people are not able to read the Siddur? Shabbos davening is pretty long. So what do you do? Not everybody knows it by heart. So what do you do then? So Rav Moshe says, that would certainly be a Tzarech Rabim. If the Erev is considered a Tzarech Rabim because people need to carry outside, then certainly the lights being on would also be a Tzarech Rabim. So you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to turn the lights on in order that people should be able to see what's going on inside of the shul. So that is with regard to a Tzarech Gadol. Let's say Rav Moshe says, if you leave the light on in the refrigerator, and as a result of the light being on, you're now unable to take any food out or put any food in. So Rav Moshe says, what should he do? So in a case like that, he says you would be allowed to ask a non-Jew to unscrew the bulb or to do something, even if it's a Malacha D'oraisa, because he says that would be a Tzarech Gadol. Why is it a Tzarech Gadol? You can say, I can go to the neighbors to eat. I can go down the block and find a meal. Yeah, you can, but that's not expected of me that I have to do that. Amir La'akum is an Issa D'Rabbanan. I'm allowed to violate the Issa D'Rabbanan of Amir La'akum, even when I'm asking the non-Jew to do a Malacha D'oraisa for the sake of a mitzvah of Oneg Shabbos. Question. A very good question. That's a very good question. I'm not sure. I don't know. I have to think about it. So there is a third category. We talked about Amir La'akum one second. We talked about Amir La'akum b'makom chole. Talked about Amir La'akum b'makom mitzvah. You had a question before we move on? Right. Yes, so we're going to get to that. Can I ask a non-Jew to do a malacha ayde shinui? That's what you're asking?
Yeah, or the cases where it's on the same level, meaning is a mirror cases where an individual can never do them, even.
Not sure I understand. What's the question?
Meaning those cases where
Okay. So let's see. We have to get through all the klalim of Amir Lenachri, and then we'll see how that plays out, right? Okay. So let's see. The third category of where we would allow Amir La'akum is if you have a Hefsid Merubah. Hefsid Merubah means I'm going to undergo a tremendous loss of money. So in a situation like that, we assume that I would be allowed to violate what we refer to as a Shvus to Shvus B'Makom Mitzvah. I'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something for me, which is only a Malacha D'Rabbanan, in order that I should not lose a tremendous amount of money. Now, tremendous amount of money is something that's very subjective, and it depends who you are. So if I'm a multimillionaire, a tremendous amount of money is going to be a very different number than for somebody who's just getting by month to month and just paying their bills. It's not going to be the same amount of money. So that's true. It is very subjective, and it depends. I actually just had the Shaila in a very different context. You know, there's a discussion in Shulchan Aruch about non-kosher wines. Are you allowed to have hana from non-kosher wines? It's referred to as stam yena. Non-kosher wine is, we don't assume that it was used for the purposes of serving Avodah Zarah, but it's referred to as stam yena. And in general, you're not supposed to have hana. So would I be allowed to give that bottle of wine to a non-Jewish friend of mine? Or perhaps not. So it's an interesting question. It seems from the Ramah that you'd be allowed, behefsid meruba, you'd be allowed to get some kind of hana from it, from stam yena. Not from wine that a non-Jew used, but from wine that a non-Jew produced. You'd be allowed to get hana if it was a hefsid merubah. So sometimes you get a bottle of schnapps or a bottle of wine and it's $150. So is that a hefsid merubah for you? I don't know. Plenty of people have wasted $150 on lots of things. Right? You go out to eat one night and it's $150. I think it's a huge waste. I mean, it's wonderful, it's nice. But you think about it, take a step back. Like, what did I just pay for? $150? It's a crazy amount of money. So some people would never think of paying so much money to go out to eat. Other people would say, no, this is what we do. It's not a big deal. If you're the kind of person that does that, then $150 on a bottle of wine doesn't seem to be a hefsid merubah. It's not a big deal. So again, it's true. It is very subjective. And it's true that there isn't a clear guideline of what's a hefsid merubah and what is not. But certainly this is something that we would allow. Now, the second level is quoted in Shulchan Aruch when the Shulchan Aruch describes, let's say you have something that is very expensive merchandise, something, let's say I left my laptop outside and it's about to rain and I'm nervous that I'm going to ruin it, I'm nervous that there's going to be something wrong. So there in a situation like that, I'd be allowed to instruct the non-Jew specifically to go bring it inside for me. Why would I be allowed to do that? The Mishnah Berurah explains the reason why is because if you're not going to allow the non-Jew to do that, if you're not going to allow the person to instruct the non-Jew to help him, he's going to do it himself. I care more about my laptop than about Shabbos. It's the tragic truth, but it's true. A lot of people care more about their possessions than they do about Shabbos itself. And therefore, even though Shabbos dictates that I shouldn't touch my computer and I shouldn't touch my laptop, if I see that it's about to get ruined outside, and you don't have some kind of allowance that we're going to give the person room to somehow save it, ultimately, they're going to end up doing it by themselves. And therefore, we assume that that would be something that would be allowed. A third category would be if you have a Sefer Torah. So if you have a Sefer Torah, the Shulchan Aruch says, and the Sefer Torah is mutal b'bizayon, whatever reason, Sefer Torah somehow ends up in the middle of the street, and you're afraid that it's going to be trampled on, it's going to be destroyed, it's going to be rained on, something's going to happen, you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew even to violate a Malacha D'Araisa to save the Sefer Torah from a bizayon. Even though you say we have 25 Sefer Torah, it's not a Hefsid Merubah. I mean, obviously, of course, for the person who owns the Sefer Torah, it is. But you would say, yeah, what's the big deal? We have plenty, you know, we could figure it out, it's not a problem, the shul will be fine. But that's a major bizayon. And not only that, the Mishnah Berurah writes, it doesn't only limit itself to Sifrei Torah, it's something that extends to all Sifrei Kodesh. So we assume if they're going to get ruined, you're allowed to ask a non-Jew. Now, part of the question that we need to think about in general, by many of these issues, is there are times when we allow a non-Jew to do something which is only Malacha D'Rabbanan, Shvus D'Shvus B'Makom Mitzvah. Most of the things, I would venture to say, most of the activities that we would potentially ask a non-Jew to be involved with are probably the use of electricity. Am I correct? Probably. Most of the things we're going to ask them to do are using electricity. And this is a major, major question that could take weeks and weeks to discuss, which obviously we're not going to do. But what is the nature of using electricity on Shabbos? The problem is that Chazal did not know anything about electricity. It was not around in their days. So they were not able to give an opinion. So we have to project, what would Chazal have said had they been alive today or 100 years ago, 115 years ago when they came up with this whole idea of electricity, what would Chazal have said would they have been alive today how would they have instructed us to approach electricity on Shabbos? Would they say that that's a malacha d'araisa? Would they say it's a malacha d'rabbanan? How could it be a malacha d'araisa? Which malacha is it? Which malacha would you pin that on? What would it be? And if it's only d'rabbanan, it makes a big difference. Why does it make a difference? Because then it becomes much easier to instruct a non-Jew to use electric circuits on Shabbos, because there are many times when we allow shvus to shvus on Shabbos. So again, this sugya of electricity on Shabbos is Arucha me'eretz mida, Rechava mineyam. There's so much to talk about. It's a sugya that is forever and ever long. However, we'll just give a little bit of the highlights. The problem here is that some say, I mean, everyone would agree, if you have, let's say, a light bulb with a filament in it, and by turning it on, it's going to get hot, that is for sure a malacha d'araisa. There's no doubt. Why? Because the Rambam says that that's part of the Isser of Havara on Shabbos. To make something hot. Havara doesn't just mean to cook something. Havara also means to take a piece of metal and to make it burning hot. That would also be Havara. So in a situation like that, that is for sure considered to be a malacha d'araisa. The question is today, most of the appliances that we have don't get hot. Most of the electrical appliances run on LEDs, run on other kinds of things, that you don't have anything that actually gets hot inside. There is no filament. So the question then becomes, how can that be a malacha, and what malacha would it be? How do you figure out how to go through that? So the Chazon Ish is of the opinion that electricity is considered to be an Isser D'Araisa on Shabbos. His suggestion is because every time you close a circuit, potentially you're violating the Isser of Boneh, because you're creating something that didn't exist before. The circuit was not created beforehand. Now that you do whatever activates the circuit, you're now violating the malacha of Boneh. Others say that when you disconnect it, when you turn it off, then you're violating the malacha of Soser. So that was the position of the Chazon Ish. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach very respectfully but very forcefully disagreed with the Chazon Ish. By the way, Shlomo Zalman, I think, was 18 at the time that he wrote his whole attack against the Chazon Ish. It's called the Sefer Ma'orei Or. And it was at the time when studying electricity was not very in style, and he was a very young man. It just shows his mastery of halacha and his mastery of the mitzias. He understood what electricity was really all about. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote a whole kuntras to explain why he thinks that you cannot say that this is considered to be boneh, you cannot consider this as soser, and he assumes that this is only a malacha d'rabbanan. So that is a very, very serious question. My father generally assumes that this is only a malacha d'rabbanan. Rav Asher Weiss happens to be in the minority on this issue. He has a very novel opinion. He actually has his opinion based on a Talmud Yerushalmi. So the Yerushalmi, the way he dramatically explains the Yerushalmi is that it says, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were learning the Malachas of Shabbos for a number of years. I think it says 3 years together, maybe longer, forgot. And after they were done, they said, oh, we know Hilchas Shabbos inside and out. Anyone who has a question can come and ask us, and we'll explain everything to you. We'll answer all your questions. So there was a long line of people. Everybody was saying, wow, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish taking questions on Masechas Shabbos. Let's hear what they have to say. And they're going through all questions one after the other. So the way he describes it is they put out 39 baskets, one for each of the Malachas. And somebody came in and had a question. Am I allowed to cut the grass on Shabbos? So he says, nope, that's kotzer. So they put it in the kotzer basket. Then they come to the next question and he says, oh, am I allowed to squeeze out my oranges? No, that's schita. So they put it in that basket. And they're filling up all the baskets with all the questions, explaining to everyone which malacha it is. And anything they didn't know, they threw into the basket of makeh bepatish. That's what it says. Anything that they couldn't say is definitively this malacha or that, they put it into an extra basket, which was makeh bepatish. So he said, you see from there, that anything that we don't know what it is, but it's clearly usher, is going to go into the basket of makeh bepatish, which is an issa d'araisa, and therefore he said, this is considered to be an issa d'araisa. Why? Because in his opinion he says that were the Rishonim to be alive today, and were the Tanaim and Amoraim to be alive today, they would certainly say that electricity is usher b'Shabbos. Where we're going to fit it in, we don't know. But it certainly goes in the basket of the miscellaneous, which is the makeh bepatish. If nothing more than that, maybe it's boneh, maybe it's soser, like the Chazon Ish said, but it's certainly something on the spectrum here, and that is his opinion. Again, it's a tremendous chiddush, very interesting, novel idea, not the generally accepted opinion, but this is a very, very interesting machlokas, and it's extremely relevant lahalacha, because it's going to determine what we're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do in our homes, and what perhaps not. Now, touching on your question a little bit, when we started learning Hilchos Shabbos, we mentioned that the only time that you're not allowed to do a malacha is when you do a malacha normally. Malachas machsheves means I intend to do something. I'm doing a malacha the normal way that people do it. The question now is, what about if I do a malacha b'shinui? So we know that there's an issur d'rabbanan. Imagine if I'm going to go the whole Shabbos and do everything with a shina. I'm going to turn the lights on with my elbow. I'm going to do this with my left hand, with my foot. So then there's going to be no malacha on Shabbos. I'm going to be able to do everything. So although it's true that you're not violating the actual malacha because it has to be done with intent, it has to be done the normal way, but doing it al yidei shinoi, doing it in a backhanded way, doing it in an unusual manner, would certainly be something that is still an issur midirabbanan. Now, in certain situations, as you very correctly said, you would be allowed to violate a malacha al yidei shinoi, certain emergency situations, and that would bump it down from being an issur d'oraisa to now being an issur d'rabbanan. Somebody just asked me last week a very important question, and I cannot understand for the life of me why there's nothing written about this. I don't understand. This must be such a common shaila. An audiologist in the neighborhood called me and said that they have rechargeable hearing aids now. And she said it's not so new. It's not like it just came out in the past 6 months. This is something that's been around for a couple of years. So she said that the hearing aids do not last for an entire... sometimes they last 24 hours, but she said many times, if let's say you have a 2-day yontif, certainly a 3-day yontif, a rechargeable hearing aid is not going to last for 3 days. Certainly not going to last. You have to plug it in. So what do you do? I don't ever think of the question. So I thought it was a fascinating question. What do? You have to plug it in at some point over the 2 or 3 days of yontif. Not everybody has a nachri around to ask to plug it in for them. So what are they supposed to do? So I happened to have found it fascinating. I called my father and I asked him what he thought. He said, I don't know, never heard the question. I have to think about it. I said, you got to think about it? This is like, this should be something that tons of people have asked. This is really, yes, I was surprised that he had to think about it, but I was more surprised that this is not something that's been asked so many times before. It's such a necessity. So many people should have this question. What? From what I understand, I don't know, but hearing aids, apparently the good ones are very expensive. Is that true? I don't know. You shouldn't know. You shouldn't have to. Oh, we missed you. You were being too quiet. Thank you. We missed you. You were being too quiet. So, my understanding is that hearing aids are very expensive. So to buy a backup hearing aid would be a wonderful etza, but maybe it's very expensive. Is a person mechuyev to do that, to spend all that money to buy a second one? Probably not. You got to figure it out. So what are you supposed to do? So I called Rav Asher Weiss. And I said, for sure, he's dealt with this in Shari Tzedek. I don't know, all the medical things he deals with. Like, I don't know, never heard the question. I said, how can this be? So I actually called up one of the guys in YU, and I said, you should write an article in English. This is like such a common issue. It's just such a prevalent issue on Shabbos. Somebody should look into this and figure out what the answer is and write about it so that other people can learn. And he said, how could it be nobody wrote it? I said, I have no idea. I actually have a kuntres at home from Rabbi Shechetovitz, who lives in Baltimore. He has, unfortunately, a number of children who were born who were deaf. And Yachad actually published a booklet from him. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, all about hearing aids on Shabbos. And it doesn't talk about this. I can't understand it. I guess it was written before. What? Yeah. So it's a new thing, but it's not so new. So anyway, it's an interesting shaila. So this person came up with a great idea. I didn't come up with this on my own. This audiologist in our neighborhood had a great idea. She said, Rabbi, here's the answer. Let me set a Shabbos clock. Once I didn't even say that idea yet. The Shabbos clock is that I'm going to plug it into the wall. The Shabbos clock is going to go on at 12 o'clock at night. It's going to go off at 6 in the morning. I'm going to go to sleep. Let's say this elderly person goes to sleep at 10 o'clock. So they're going to plug it in when the Shabbos clock is off. And then it will charge. By the time they unplug it at 8 o'clock in the morning when they wake up, the Shabbos clock is off again. But it already charged overnight. I thought that was such a brilliant idea. I have no idea if that works. But it's a great idea. We do it every week with Hatzalah radios. What do we do? What do we do with Hatzalah radios?
You bought the radio charger. Put it in Shabbos clock. Put it in when it's off. Let it charge a couple hours and take it out.
So does that really work? That's a good question. No, of course it works. Of course it works. Halachically, does it work? Does that make a difference? My father was not convinced that that actually helps. My father was not convinced just because it's off doesn't make a difference. You're still finishing off it. Again, for Pikuach Nefesh, of course it's mutter. So what we were thinking about was, this person, if they're not going to have their hearing aids on Shabbos, are they a chol she'yesh b'sakana? No. But they're definitely a chol she'ein b'sakana, right? If the Shulchan Aruch says, you have somebody who's cold, and we're allowed to ask a nachri to do a malacha for them, even a malacha de'araisa, because hakol cholam etzel tzina, because they can't function normally, they're too cold, So what would you say? Somebody who's not able to hear the whole Shabbos, what are you going to tell them? No, Friday night, you should be able to hear and enjoy all the conversation with your friends. Shabbos, I'm sorry, you're not going to be allowed to. I heard a new one this week. You're not going to believe this. This week, there was some Shabbaton somewhere. So I asked one of the girls on Sunday morning in our shul. I saw the girl came for some youth program. I happened to bump into her in the hallway. I knew she was going on this thing. So I said to her, you know, how did it go over Shabbos? She said, it was really nice. I said, did you meet this and this person who came in from Eretz Yisrael for the Shabbaton? You know, I know they came special. She said, yeah, I did meet her. So I said, did she speak? Why'd she come? Did she give sessions? Like, what was she doing? She said, well, I don't know. Friday night she spoke. She was very involved. And then Shabbos day, she didn't come out of her room. I said, why? She said, well, she's from Israel. So she ended Shabbos Israel time. I'm like, wow, that's a new one. So Sunday night, I was at a wedding with my father and Rabbi Willig. I turned to them. I said, you're not going to believe this. This is really a new one. Did you ever hear of an Israeli who's in America who decides to end Shabbos at, these days, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, right? Shabbos is over. So Rabbi Willig said, wow, that's a very new one. Anyway, I called up the head of this program and I said, I'm not getting involved in your policies and your whatever. I just want you to know, I guess from here on in, we have to make an announcement that any staff member who comes from Israel to a Shabbaton here or any of our staff who go there need to observe Shabbos based on the place where they are. Like if you're in Israel for Shabbos, you can't start Shabbos at 3 o'clock in the morning. You have to start Shabbos at the time when the sun goes down in Israel. So I said, maybe we have to put this into the protocols of your organization that anyone who flies... So this person was so upset, and he said, as far as I'm concerned, this is grounds for firing. This is not like we give you another chance. So I don't know, who am I to decide? I have no idea. I said, look, that's your own issue. I asked my father what he thought about that. He said, no, it's not ground for firing. Somebody could have made an honest mistake and really doesn't understand. Now, the person who runs the program said, well, if you're that incompetent and you know that little, you shouldn't be running a program that has a lot of Jewish teenagers in it, because what else do you not know? Interesting. Anyway, an interesting debate. But don't make that mistake. Certainly Shabbos starts when Shabbos starts here. Shabbos ends when Shabbos ends here. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, it goes based on where you are. How did I get into this? I have no idea. But it was an interesting idea. Anyway, so about the hearing aids. So this was actually the thought process. I would assume that somebody who doesn't have... Oh, that's why. Because the girl said that she didn't hear this counselor the whole Shabbos. So that's why I was reminded of it the whole Shabbos day. So what are you going to tell this person? Your hearing aid, perfect Friday night. But Shabbos day, okay, I'm sorry. You're going to have to sit around and not be able to hear anything. And you'll have to talk to yourself. You know, that's just the way it's going to have to be. And you know, your husband, your wife will scream at you and you just won't hear them. Maybe that's Onik Shabbos. I don't know. It's good. Yes. So that's the question. So I would definitely say that such a person is a cholosh emos hakana. Their life is not in danger, but they are not functioning normally. They're certainly not functioning to the normal capacity. When you have a cholosh emos hakana, we allow certain things to be done. We do allow certain things to be done. So as we mentioned, you would allow amir lenachri to be done for a cholosh emos hakana. We would allow, let's say, perhaps a malacha yidei shinui. So my father thought over here, if you have this contraption with the Shabbos clocks, he didn't even think it was so necessary to do that, but he thought that definitely we would allow the person to plug it in ayidei shinui. So the question is, what is a shinui? What is a shinui when you plug something in? What's considered a shinui? I can't do it with my elbows. Like, it's never going to happen. I told my father, you have somebody who's also elderly, you know, they're not going to be able to do a shinui so easily. So he thought, since it requires a little bit of dexterity to actually take the plug and put it into the hearing aid, it's not so easy. So he thought if you do it with the left hand, that's already enough of a shinui. Again, obviously if it's a lefty, you do it with the right hand. But he thought that just changing the hand would already be enough of a shinui. I thought this was an interesting chiddush, an interesting idea. We need to think about it a little more. Yes? Correct. No, I don't think you're correct. I don't think it's correct. No. Everyone would agree. In Shulchan Aruch it says, "Acholish emes hakana," you're allowed to do certain things for. The Shulchan Aruch then goes further and says, there are two people who are always considered in the category of Acholish emes hakana. Number one is a katan, and number two is somebody who's cold. But the category of Acholish emes hakana, for sure you're allowed to do something for. So, what is the definition of a cholosh emes hakana? That's the question. Many achronim say, this is what my father accepts, many achronim say, somebody who is mutal mishkav, What does it mean, muta lemishkav? He's not functioning to his normal capacity. Right? So say, for example, you have a woman who's on birth control pills. And every day she has to take the pill. If she doesn't take the pill, she's nervous, maybe she's going to get pregnant. Right? She doesn't want that. So you're going to tell her on Shabbos she's not allowed to take the pill? That's in some way a chilul shem sakana. Why? Well, she's not sick. There's nothing wrong. Nothing's going to happen. She's not going to get sick. But because I can't function normally, I can't do the things that I would normally do. So therefore, I'm a chilul shem sakana. Now you'll say, oh, I can't play my video games on Shabbos. So I'm also a chilul shem sakana. Obviously, it's unreasonable. We're talking about somebody who does regular functioning of the average person like themselves or in their community. So that's a chilul shem sakana. You're saying, would you say that a person, when it's 90 degrees outside and it's boiling hot in the house, would we say that that person is a cholah? That's arguable. Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa says, maybe we should extend that dispensation of being cold to nowadays also being hot. That's arguable. But someone who's a cholah shemes akana is a cholah shemes akana for sure. I would definitely say that somebody who doesn't have the ability to use their hearing aids on Shabbos because they're not charged is a cholah shemes akana. They're not able to use their hearing on Shabbos. It's going to devastate them for the rest of Shabbos. And we have to come up with some kind of solution. Now, what that solution is, I think everyone should think about a little bit, a creative solution. But it's definitely something that's very interesting. Yeah. Cheresh hamedaber ve'eno shomea.
Based on you, you're putting him into that category.
I would say he's a... again, over there, a cheresh hamedaber ve'eno shomea never hears. So it's not unusual for him this Shabbos. This person is able to hear. And now you're taking away their ability to hear because they have no etza. That's not the same. Right? I think there's a big distinction. What? You're not functioning normally. The reason you're not functioning normally is because normally I have a hearing aid, now I don't. So how are we going to figure out how to give you a hearing aid?
But with any type of artificial anything that helps you function better.
Right. Let's say people who have sleep apnea, right? Once in a while they forget to put it on at night, to put on the, what's it called again? The CPAP, thank you. Once in a while they forget to put it on, they don't turn on the machine, and they're fine. They don't, you know, it's not a sakana. They have a major issue in the middle of the night, of course they turn it on. But they're okay. Would we allow them to figure out how to turn it on Shabbos? What would you say? Of course. Why? Again, you have to figure out how, get an achri, a shinui, whatever it is. But of course you're allowed to. Why? Because my normal way of going to sleep is that I'm comfortable. How am I comfortable? By using the machine. How am I going to be on Shabbos? So I'm not going to die if I don't use it. Again, I'm not talking about an extreme case. I'm not going to be comfortable. I'm not going to be able to sleep normally. I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night because I'm not sleeping the regular way. In a situation like that, we would certainly allow it. What about asking a non-Jew to do an Issur D'Oraisa with a Shinui? So that's what you were talking about before. So if I do a Malacha on Shabbos with a Shinui, I, meaning a Jew, we're assuming that I, Shechter, I'm Jewish, so if I do a Malacha with a Shinui, that is considered to be a Malacha D'Rabbanan. It bumps it down. I actually got a Shaila today. Not sure what the answer is. It could be it's obvious. Nothing to do with this either, when we're talking about Jews and non-Jews. So somebody called me today that they're getting married, and this girl told me her father's not Jewish. So what do you write in the Ksuba? Not exactly sure. What? So I'm not sure, do you write the mother's name? Do you write, I don't know. I have to look it up. Interesting question. I asked, just curious. I said, where are you getting married? Oh, we're getting married in this Jewish, whatever it is. I said, who's catering? He told me. I spoke to Dov Schreier from the OU. I said, is that a kosher caterer? He's like, I don't think so. He's like, Shai, you got a much bigger problem than the ksuba on your hands. Anyway, so we have to figure out what to do. But anyway, if a Jew does a malacha, al yidei shinoi, it gets bumped down from being a malacha d'araisa to now become a malacha d'rabbana. What happens if I ask a non-Jew to do a malacha al yidei shinoi? What would you say? So this is quoted in the Mishnah Brura in Hilchos Shabbos, where he tells the story about a woman who needs to go to the mikvah on Friday night, and she forgot to cut her nails. A woman who doesn't cut her nails is considered to be a chatzitza. So she can't really go to the mikvah. So you can say, All right, so let her go tomorrow night. What's the big deal, right? But that's not what we do. We figure out how to make some kind of dispensation for her. What dispensation we're going to make? So in a situation like that, the Mishnah Berurah quotes from the Magen Avraham that a woman whose Leil Tefillah is Friday night, you can ask a Nachri to come. And he says the Nachri is allowed to cut the nails with her own hands. What do you mean with her own hands? Why should she do it with her own hands? Why can't she take a scissors? So what it seems is that I'm asking an Achri to do something that is important, right, to take care of this woman, but I'm only allowed to do it when I'm asking for a shvus to shvus. I'm asking, number one, for a malacha, I'm asking an Achri, which is a derabanan, and the second thing that I'm asking for is that they should do it al yidei shinui. So this is a very, very big discussion among the Achronim. How much would we allow, and how much would we not? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as well as Rabbi Yashiv, have a major discussion where they're not entirely sure. Here, I'm trying to find where it is. They're not entirely sure about what we would allow or not. Here, he says over here, if you look at number 38, I see we're out of time already. If you look at number 38, which is on page 26, you'll see that there's a major discussion about what we would allow and what perhaps we would not. And really a lot of this hinges on that case of the woman who has to go to the mikvah on Leil Tefillah. It happens to be that, if I remember correctly, it's a machlokas, the Shachan, the Taz, and Yerodea, about whether or not somebody who has a malacha being done on their own body, right? So over here, the cutting the nails is being done on my body. So is that considered to be, when I have Amir al-Akam on that, is that considered to be on like a higher level, because I'm sort of participating? It's not like I'm asking the Nachri to do something that is disconnected from me. I'm asking the Nachri to do malacha on my body, to cut my nails. So maybe that's considered to be something that I'm an active participant in, and that would be far more problematic. The example I mentioned a few weeks ago was when we had a baby on Friday night, our first child, so we were careful, there was no malacha at all, but then they asked that my wife do a fingerprint. Fingerprint is a major shaila. Is that considered to be kosev or not? The Rambam writes, when he talks about the malach of ksiva, he says that potentially when we talk about ksiva, it's not only writing letters, but ksiva is also, we're going to dive more here in 2 minutes, ksiva is also in a situation where I have what he refers to as roshem, where I try to put something together and now it looks different than it looked before and it looks coherent. So if I draw a picture, even though it doesn't have aleph beis on it, that's also considered to be a malach of ksiva. So in a situation like that, the Ragachever has a tshuva where he discusses the finger druk. He says very often the practice was in Europe that the policeman would just stop somebody in the middle of the street and ask them to take a fingerprint for no good reason, not because they were being arrested, they just wanted to know. So that potentially, the Ragachever writes, should be considered a potential malacha de'araisa of roshem, according to the way the Rambam understands it. If that's the case, I was nervous about this. So then I said to the nurse, you know, my wife is not feeling well, can you do it for her? So the nurse took my wife's finger, no big deal, she dipped it in, put it on. Then I said, oh, that's the machlokas, the Magen Avraham and the Taz. When someone's doing a malacha on my body, does it help that I ask the Nachri to do it? After all, maybe I ask the doctor to do that, I don't know. Does it help that I ask the Nachri to do it? After all, the Nachri's doing a malacha on me. Does that matter? Maybe it should be considered like I'm doing the malacha, since he's doing it on my body. So that's a very, very relevant question. Again, it's worth reading number 38. Next week we will continue, but these are some of the very important highlights about Amir al-Akram.